Really, where I'm trying to do is, and it's sort of a huge topic to do in one sort of quick workshop, is wrestle with the fact that there has been, for a significant amount of time, efforts at redefinition of the mission of the church, which then have an impact on the mission of missions and what missions is. Is that, do you think there's any chance you could stop this thing from cycling? Okay, because I keep thinking, did I just put something on the screen? Because I can see it right here, and I'm, oh, that's interesting. You know, I'm easily distracted, so it's not a good thing. Pardon? No, it just keeps popping in, huh? Yeah, can you hear me if I step out too?
We're not recording anything.
Not very well.
Not very well. So, all right,
I'll try and stay right in the speaking range then. So what we have, I think, is a tension that we always wrestle with. Really going back into the early 1900s, we're going to look at that. That it has resurfaced, and I think in some senses more dangerously, because we're not fighting about it. And that's I guess the part of the concern is, it's almost an assumption that some of these arguments are correct. And so what I'd like to do is just walk through that, somewhat survey some biblical theological evaluation side of it and approach it from that. I think it's important because we're always subject to influence by the writings, ministries, and movements of our day in ways I think we recognize this in the secular culture. Okay, so things are happening in the secular culture, and it's, you know, we use the old frog in the kettle kind of a deal. You know, what happens is something that would have been perceived as absolutely unacceptable 40 years ago now is just sort of, you know, we see it and we think, I don't like it, but that's just the way life is. And the same kind of thing can happen in the church with regard to our theology and philosophy of ministry. I mean, things that we would have looked at ages ago and said, no way, all of a sudden have just become so commonplace that we start to assume they're right. And I think we have to recognize the danger in that. I think there's less debate about this particular issue than there ought to be. The contemporary church is beginning to assume things that I think should be continuously affirmed. And I would say this is some things that should be denied. For instance, and we're going to get to it, but the priority of the proclamation of the gospel in missions. We can tend to assume that. Yeah, that's what's going on. When in fact, it might not be. I mean, I sat in Istanbul almost 7 years ago. We have three families from our church that have gone over there. And we went on a survey trip, and we were talking with folks who are working there. And there was a man there funded by what we would consider to be a conservative evangelical group who was explaining what he was doing. And what he was doing was actually building a business, a coffee bean business, and said, I mean, very openly, you know, my job is to build that business and disciple the Turkish believer who will take it over. And that was it. And he had no direct connection to the advance of the gospel, the establishment of local assemblies. He was fully funded as a missionary to build a coffee business. Okay? And in the same course of the conversation, talking with another fellow that said, well, you know, even if we don't get certain things done, at least we've been here and we've been a light in a dark place, meaning, you know, we've lived as Christians. And I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but I would suggest to you that missions isn't just simply being a Christian somewhere. I mean, that's not what the New Testament demonstration or teaching of what missions is. So when all of a sudden person A moving to another place becomes missions, then pretty much everything is missions. And we've lost any meaningful concept of what missions is or is not. And I think that's a part of what concerns me in this. The third is the implications of this, I think you can see, have enormous impact on the work of God. If the things that I'm going to say are influencing us actually are changing the definition of the mission of the church and therefore missions itself, then that's going to have significant long-term effects. And we don't actually have to guess about that. All we have to do is look back to the beginning of the 20th century and we can see that it actually happened. So it's not as if we're just making it up and saying, don't do that, bad things could happen. We can say, don't do that, bad things happened when that was done. And so we should look at it that way. So I guess if I could put it in just to sort of set the agenda before we go into this, I guess if there is a driving point of concern for me, it would be this, is that there are efforts to broaden the mission of the church which are adversely affecting the cause of missions. Okay, and that's a little bit fuzzy because if I try to explain all of that right at the front end, then we're going to, you know, then I would have done the workshop before I get into this workshop, all right? But the basic point is there are efforts to broaden the mission of the church to, let's say, just for sake of argument, okay? Probably, I wouldn't be surprised that most of your churches represent this room have something in the bylaws of your church that say something like the church exists for the glory of God by evangelizing sinners and edifying the saints. I mean, that's probably because most of us have sort of historic bylaws, articles of faith. That's what we have, right? And what I'm saying is there is a deliberate effort to expand the mission of the church beyond that, to include things that historically were not included as the mission of the church. Sometimes that's called holistic mission, integral mission. If I use one famous church in North Chicago, they would say they exist for exaltation, evangelism, edification, and social action. So they would be saying, you know, the first three, similar to what I just said, right? Glorify God by evangelizing sinners, edifying the saints, but then they add social action. Okay, so to pursue social justice, to take on social aspects of it. So broadening the mission of the church in that way is then affecting our view and concept of missions. That's the basic concern. Now let me just try to run quickly through a sort of historical backdrop, and I'd commend to you an older book that if you can get and you're interested in sort of heavy history but valuable stuff. All right, a book by Arthur Johnston called The Battle for World Evangelism, in which he documents, I'm going to talk about three rounds of infiltration. He talks about two rounds, the first two rounds, the Edinburgh to the ecumenical movement, and then talks about Luzon movement. Now, I'm going to add a third movement in, the missional movement, which is after that book was written and after some of these things have developed. But I would suggest to you that these cycles of influence have all been aimed at changing, broadening the mission of the church, and therefore affecting our view of missions. All right? And the first round was, I've got in your notes there, from Edinburgh to the ecumenical movement. In 1910, really sort of as the culmination and I think the beginning of the collapse of the student volunteer movement, was a world congress held in 1910 in Edinburgh, Scotland. And the student volunteer movement started in the late 1800s, you know, with Moody and Northfield, all those conferences going on, and a real push to evangelize this world, our world in this generation. That was sort of the motto that they pushed on it. Well, as that picked up steam, it picked up some organizational strength, and beginning at 1910, was a call to sort of systematize that. And it really planted the seeds of the ecumenical movement that by 1961 brought the fruit of the student volunteer movement into the World Council of Churches. And it started in 1910 because they made two significant decisions, one deliberate decision and then one influence. The deliberate decision was they were going to minimize doctrine for the sake of unity. David Hesselgrave, actually, because 2010 was the 100-year anniversary, Cape Town 2010 was chosen because it would be 100 years after Edinburgh. There was actually conferences in Edinburgh. Hesselgrave, who's nobody's flaming fundamentalist at all, wrote about the error of Edinburgh in an article that got put into the Southwestern Theological Journal, and it was that they deliberately downplayed doctrine in order to pursue unity, and therefore opened up the door to progressive expansion in the ecumenical movement, which ultimately led to them just being swept into under the World Council of Churches, which was and is, I think, by any orthodox, and I mean biblically orthodox person's assessment, an organization full of false doctrine and apostasy. So it went from a thoroughly gospel-preaching movement to a part of an apostate movement in that window of time from 1910 to 1961, so half a century. The second element, which in the words of the leader of the movement, John R. Stott, was, it is in 1909, just before it, it is believed by discerning leaders that one of the most distinctive features of the next decade in the life of the student movement is to be a larger recognition and realization by the students of their social responsibility. All right, so here you have a movement that was to reach this world in our generation, and it was clearly reached this world with the gospel. By 1910, the influence of what we would call historically the social gospel was coming in so that the students were saying, we need to be concerned about the social responsibility. Because in 1910, post-millennialism, some thought that we could actually achieve a kingdom, that we would be able to really bring Christ reigning on the earth, was dominant. I mean, it was before World War I. And so Johnston says, Edinburgh, 1910 hoped to harness the global forces of Christianity to complete world evangelization and to introduce the coming kingdom of God upon the earth. It served rather to hinder evangelism by what it did not say concerning the authority of Scripture and what it did through the agencies that grew out of it. And I have a statement in your notes there from a later conference, okay? 1961, and this is where this trail led to, all right? Witness to the gospel must therefore be prepared to engage in the struggle for social justice and peace. It will have to take the form of humble service and a practical ministry of reconciliation amidst the actual conflicts of our times. The wholeness of the gospel demands a corporate expression since it concerns every aspect of men's lives. Healing and the relief of distress, the attack upon the social abuses and reconciliation, as well as preaching, Christian fellowship, and worship are all bound together in the message that is proclaimed. All right, so here, and again, I'm assuming something here that I might be in danger of assuming, but I'm assuming that what they just said is objectionable. That in fact, in 1961, most evangelicals and fundamentalists would have read that and said, whoa, time out. You're saying the mission of the church includes all of those things and that missions is aimed at those things? Okay, 52 years ago, all of the Orthodox people, fundamentalist, evangelical, would have been saying, hang on. That is not grounded in the Scriptures. That is actually going to derail the cause of missions. And in fact, that's what happened. In 1966, someone not of our particular stripe, Billy Graham, organizes a conference in Berlin to accentuate the primacy of gospel preaching in the mission of the church and missions, and calls them to reject the movement in the World Council of Churches and ecumenical movement to downplay the need for the gospel, the preaching of the gospel, and the verbal proclamation of the gospel. So there's a movement that rises up in 66. The problem was, if I could put it this way, the camel's nose was already fully into the tent. Okay, so between 66 and 74, then what was a clear affirmation of the priority of evangelism, the necessity of proclamation, the centrality of it to missions, by 1974, there's already beginning to be a waffling on that, with John Stott emerging as the leader at the Lausanne Conference and movement and starting to introduce the concept of holistic mission. And that's what Johnson's book is about. He's writing as a professor at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. David Hesselgrave, a professor at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, now retired from there, writing about the danger to the concept of missions that's being posed within evangelicalism. Not now from outside of it, but actually from within it. And that's the second round of infiltration, the Lausanne movement. It met in July of 1974 in Switzerland. There were 2,700 participants from 150 nations representing at least six languages. While it affirmed the priority of evangelism, it raised the issue of social action to an issue of higher concern. Okay, certainly higher than 66, because between 66 and 74, there were a series of regional conferences, the most aggressive of which was in Colombia, but even the two that were in the United States pushed the edges on it and talked about the mission of the church, including both of these responsibilities of witness and works that are connected to it. Here's two statements from John Stott that I think represent a little bit, and it's in your notes there. For if the Christian mission is to be modeled on Christ's mission, it will surely involve for us, as it did for him, an entering into other people's worlds. Incarnational mission, whether evangelistic or social or both, necessitates a costly identification with people in their actual situations. Now notice, though, okay, mission here, whether evangelistic or social. So he actually is legitimizing there that you can be on mission and not be evangelistic. You can be in mission and have it be social, or you could be doing both. And so that was starting to come out in Stott's interpretation of the Lausanne Covenant. In another book he writes, "Nor do I feel able to withdraw the conviction that our mission is to be is to be modeled on Christ, just as his love for us is like the Father's love for him, so his sending us into the world is like the Father's sending him into the world. If words and works went together in his ministry, they should also in ours." And by what he means by works there is equivalent things to what Jesus did. All right, Jesus healed the sick, he fed the hungry. They take the quote from Isaiah, he set captives free, he concerned about the poor and oppressed. So all of those works affecting the social environment in which we live, that is a part of what our mission of being sent by Christ is to include. So that's why you can say whether social or evangelistic or some kind of both. And from 74... moving forward, there was this continual negotiation of what it means. Stott originally went with, it's like two wings of a bird. Okay? Words and works, evangelism and social action, a bird has to have both wings to fly, or like two blades of a pair of scissors. You have to have both. They have to both function. So they said they had to be joined together in the mission of the church. Edward Dayton, writing back, looking at it, I think helps us understand the transition that I'm concerned about. And this is a little bit longer quote, but I want to make sure you I think it's important to know the history of it, at least even in a sketch form. Here's what Dayton said. In the 8 years between Berlin and Lausanne, there was a tremendous movement in the evangelical part of Christ's church. Lausanne was intended to be a congress of those involved in trying to reach the world. But the Holy Spirit was also enlivening the minds of men and women to expand our understanding of what it meant to evangelize. The Lausanne Covenant greatly broadened our worldviews. We were called to see that the task of evangelization was not confined to sharing to the sharing of information about Jesus. There was a life to be lived. We saw the need for the broad redemption of the world in all its aspects. The year of Lausanne, 1974, might also be described as a watershed year in Western evangelicals' interest in social concerns. Okay, and that's in a book called The Church in Response to Human Need, and his title is Social Transformation, the Mission of God. So he's saying between 66 and 74, there was a radical realtering of the way people were thinking about the mission of the church. And that mission was that our goal was not simply to share information about Jesus, but to transform the world and therefore become the justification for it. Here in the same book, he says this, and what is social transformation to the Christian? Is it not the entire business that God is about, namely the redemption of the world? And is not the mission of the church social transformation in every dimension? So he's clearly pushing that there is an element of the mission of the church which is to transform the society. Okay, that was written in the 80s, connected to the 82 consultation. So that became sort of a dominating theme against which people like Castlegrave and Johnston were arguing because they saw the ramifications of that for missions. They saw what that would mean. In fact, here's what Hasselgrave says not that long ago in looking back at what's happened to what he would call North American evangelical missiology. All right, he would say this, it can now be divided into basically two mainstreams or groups. One group thinks of Christian mission as being a broad enterprise encompassing all those good things that the church and its missions are doing or should be doing in the world. The other group still holds to the more narrow and traditional view that the Christian mission basically has to do with world evangelization, with proclaiming the gospel and planting New Testament churches. Other ministries may indeed be both Christian and important, but they are secondary or supporting and not the heart of Christian mission. Okay, do you see the distinction that Hasselgrave is saying? And Hasselgrave, I think, would say, and I would say it, if you look at the landscape today, the first group he talks about, which is basically doing just about any good thing in the name of Christ, is considered missions. Versus thinking that missions is preaching the gospel and planting churches. I would say in evangelicalism and fundamentalist circles, this view is winning. Because I think almost at the street level, the idea of a missionary in our world is someone who goes somewhere else to do something good for Jesus. Not someone who goes to preach the gospel, to see converts won and churches established. And what's happened is we have had the whole landscape change so that there's just sort of an assumption that digging wells in Kenya is missions. That's missions because it's a good deed in the name of Christ. It's salt and light. I mean, it's missions. And I think, and hopefully there's no well diggers from Kenya here at the conference. I was just trying to pick something that could illustrate it. But that's the concern. Okay, and so what was happening, in the first round through the broader movement, which became the World Council of Churches, the same language, and it's been documented. I mean, what they talked about in the first part of the 20th century was holistic evangelism. What John Stott went and just sort of cherry-picked out of their stuff was a concept of holistic mission. By 2010 at Cape Town, it was called integral mission. That is something that's whole. And so they focus on that and very clearly advocate in Cape Town, which was, you know, is the era of the Luzon movement, that the mission of Jesus Christ is in fact for the church to eradicate poverty, address issues of human trafficking, HIV, political oppressive systems, that's the mission of the church to do those things. Which means if that's the mission of the church, then somebody who wants to go tackle that can be a missionary of the church. Right? I mean, that's the logic that follows. If the mission of the church exists to stop human trafficking, then somebody who decides to become dedicated to that process could be appointed as a missionary that's designed exclusively to try and fight against human trafficking. Now, I hope this doesn't even have to say, I'm against human trafficking. Everybody in this room should be against human trafficking. That's not the issue. Did Jesus Christ commission the church to go to all the nations and stop human trafficking? In blunt terms, that's the question. Is that what we were commissioned to do? Is that our mission? Because that's what a mission comes from, being commissioned. Have we been commissioned to do that? And I think now, the fact that you can get 30,000 students into a dome in Georgia to pledge themselves to stop human trafficking, try and get those 30,000 there to come and say, we're going to go preach the gospel and plant churches. And it's because that stuff motivates. And I'm not certain it's all a motivation driven by submission to the authority of God's word. So there's the second infiltration. The third was, and some of this was happening, but basically the fact that all of this conversation about missions and wrestling through this with missions, and then the change in our cultures around us. Newbegin in the 80s coming back starts to write and says the West is actually a mission field. So you actually have people start saying, listen, we need to start treating our culture as if we're missionaries. We need to be missional. And so the turn was to how do we go into our culture? How do we accomplish that? And the whole missional thing could take a ton of stuff, but at the heart of it is, at least in the missiologically wired side of it, is how do we serve as missionaries in our culture? And if we have now for three decades been saying the way to get entry into a culture is to come in doing good to gain a hearing, to come in and try and change the socio-political system, to do all, if that's what we've been saying we should be doing over there, then certainly that's what we should be doing here. So it's not uncommon, and again, if you want to talk after, I mean, I can point you to the references on this, but some of the schools that we would have historically considered to have been fundamentalist schools, now we might, you know, sometimes they would claim to be conservative evangelical schools. Some probably would rightly be out past that, requiring every freshman, for instance, to come in and read a book called True Religion that says the mission of the church is to take heaven, okay, pieces of heaven, and bring it to places of hell on earth. and defines the mission as a leaving. Even so bold as to say that what Jesus did first was alleviate physical suffering before he talked about himself. So that should be the priority in how we go forward. So entire generations now of young people are being taught that the mission of Jesus Christ is to alleviate places of hell on earth, not rescue people from the hell that's coming. Actually try and change the fact that they're living in a temporal hell now. So it's justifying fully and completely a radical reorientation of it. And so you've got a scenario in which the assumption now is not that there is any priority on preaching the gospel, because basically, and this is a little bit simplistic, but basically the old caricature that started back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, is that all we care about is people's souls. We don't care about their bodies. That eventually won the day. So the last thing you want to say in the face of pandemic poverty or AIDS is you need to trust Jesus because you might die and go to hell. You're heartless if that's what you lead with. You need to lead with, get them some food, get them some medicine, show them that you care about them, then you can talk to them about Jesus. And I don't want to pit things against each other as if we shouldn't do any of the others, but here's what's ended up happening, okay? And missiologists can chart it out. If you take categories of missions, the percentage of those devoted to gospel proclamation and church planting is going down. The percentage of them devoted to development, relief, care for temporal concerns is going up. And the amount of money being given is radically shifting over. Now, again, don't get me wrong. We actually have, our church takes up what we would call benevolence offering for the care of people in that kind of situation. And we put in about $100,000 a year to help provide an orphanage in Tanzania and help with one in India that comes out of a deacon's fund offering. It's not our missions. So I'm not in any way saying, who gives a rip about those orphans? What I am saying, though, is that caring for orphans, housing, and food is not missions. And I know I've got missionary friends that they can make appeals for orphans, and they get money like crazy. They make an appeal to train men to preach the gospel, and they got to pull teeth. Because something has happened in the heart and mindset of what the call of Christ is to his church that is much broader than what Jesus commissioned us to do. That's what I would suggest. Okay, and it is close to pervasive, I think. So let me try to now turn toward biblical evaluations. And I put in three categories that I'm really just going to have to do summary stuff on, all right? John Stott has been enormously influential, but what he did was he actually picked up the language of the ecumenical movement that talked about ministry in terms of incarnation versus proclamation. All right, and so Stott became the what I would say the evangelical conduit into evangelical fundamental churches of that kind of an imagery. And the point would be is how should we conceive of the church as a commissioned group? Do we conceive of the church as a proclamation mission? Or do we conceive of the church in terms of the incarnation? Now, the ground that Stott stands on is John chapter 17, verse 18, and John chapter 20 and verse 21, which John 17 is Jesus' prayer He's talking to the Father. He says, as you sent me into the world, I'm sending them into the world. And then in 2021, it becomes, you know, basically the commission text in the Gospel of John. He says, so Jesus said to them, peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, I also send you. I mean, we sing, so send I you. I mean, that's the point. This is John's commission text in terms of it. And so here you can see even in the argument that Stott's saying this, he's putting all the emphasis on, as the Father sent me, so I send you. And so he says, so how did Jesus come into the world? He came incarnationally. That is, he lived among us, learned our language, identified with us in our hopes and hurts. He ministered to our needs. And so the church should be like Jesus. And the model for the mission of Jesus Christ is an incarnational one. And I would suggest to you that he's wrong. Okay, and I've put a couple reasons there, actually three. First is it's a misuse of the Great Commission text. I mean, you probably, if you've had any kind of Bible interpretation class, you learn an axiom that says you interpret obscure text in light of what? Clear text. All right, so we have commission texts, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Acts, and John. All right? Matthew's go make disciples, baptizing them, teaching them to observe all I commanded. Mark is preach the gospel to every creature. Luke is that the forgiveness of sins in my name should be proclaimed beginning at Jerusalem to the uttermost parts of the earth. Acts is you'll be witnesses to me in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria. So those are absolutely clear about the proclamational responsibility of the church. Stott takes a statement which is not completely clear exactly as to the content of the mission, as the Father sent me, so send I you, and now makes it the interpretive grid over the top of the other ones, which is just bad interpretation. But it's also bad exegesis, because the point of those texts is not the as and so. The point of the text is sent and send. And in fact, you can see that just if you listen to what Stott does. As the Father sent me, so send I you. And what's his question? His question isn't, how did the Father send him? His question is, how did Jesus come? So he actually has to change the whole language of the issue. All right, he has to switch it around. If you look at John's gospel, and there's a New Testament scholar, Andreas Kostenberg, who's written a book called The Mission of Jesus and His Disciples, which I think was his PhD dissertation on the sending mission language in the Gospel of John, really it obliterates Stott's position on it. Because if you're going to stay inside even the Gospel of John, John chapter 4 says that in the context of the Samaritan woman, remember the disciples come back and they want to give him lunch. He says, I have food to eat that you do not know. And they said, you know, someone give him lunch. He says, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work. And then he goes into an explanation of the harvest that's coming. And then he says to the disciples, you're being sent to reap where other people have sowed. And you know what that text emphasizes? Doesn't emphasize Jesus' healing ministry, feeding ministry, any of that. In fact, it very explicitly emphasizes the testimony, because the people of Samaritans come out and say, we believe because of what you said to the Samaritan woman, but now we believe because we've heard him ourselves. It was his teaching that was in fact his mission. And he said that in Mark chapter 1, right? He had just healed all kinds of people. The crowd gathers to him. He goes out into a solitary place to pray. The disciples come out and said, everyone's looking for you. And Jesus says, let's depart and go into the other cities so that we can preach the kingdom, because that was why I was sent. That's what he says in Mark 1:38. So if you really want to say, the Father commissioned the Son, the Son commissioned us, then what did the Father commission the Son to do? Mark 1:38 says he came to preach the good news of the kingdom. John chapter 17, in the very context that Stott appeals to, John 17:4 says, I've glorified you on the earth, having accomplished the work which you gave me to do. 6 says, I have manifested your name unto the men that you gave me, and they have kept your word. So Jesus says, I did what you gave me to do. I revealed your name. They kept your word. 17:18, as you sent me, I'm sending them. 17:20, I'm not praying for them alone, but on those who will believe on me, what? Through their word. So if you're actually going to handle John 17 right, you have to say the mission of Jesus Christ was proclamation. It was an incarnation in a way that emphasized something other than proclamation. In fact, I think there's a misunderstanding of, and this is the third point, of Christ's ministry. The nature and purpose of the incarnation is unrepeatable. Do you realize that you have always been incarnate? Jesus became incarnate because he existed, the Son of God existed in a pre-incarnate state. He didn't have a body. For him to fulfill his redemptive purpose, Hebrews 2 says it was necessary for him to be made like his brethren of flesh and blood. The incarnation is a miracle of enormous theological significance. It's not a symbol. It's not an illustration. It was, in fact, an unrepeatable miracle that produced one person with two natures. That's what the incarnation was. It wasn't about Jesus learning Hebrew. It wasn't about Jesus being a cross-cultural missionary. Okay, tell that to the Gentiles that Jesus tells his disciples, don't go to them. Okay, it just doesn't fit. It's a prefabricated grid placed down on the Bible to get into mission what we want to get into it. It also, I think, misunderstands the nature and purpose of his miracles, and this comes back to the point of what Jesus was doing there. Okay, why did Jesus do what he did? It was to authenticate himself as the Messiah. These were signs. Okay, was he moved with compassion? Absolutely. But was it just raw compassion apart from the testimony of who he was? No. It wasn't. It was, in fact, intended to demonstrate that he was the Messiah, and those miracles had that kind of confirming purpose to them. And that's why they were miracles. And I have the gift of sarcasm, so it keeps starting to pop out, and I'm trying to restrain it because not many of you know me, and you might just think I'm just being an idiot. So, but think about this, all right? Telling a man who's been lame for 38 years to get up and pick up his pallet and walk away. Okay, put that on one side and put a clinic on the other side where you're dispensing malaria medicine. How does that authenticate the messiahship of Christ when on the other side of the village is somebody from the UN handing out malaria medicine too? I mean, the people who deny the very deity of Christ have a clinic set up on the other side of town. And they're not only giving malaria medicine, they're giving mosquito nets out. How is that authenticating the messiahship of Jesus? It's not. It's standing there telling the guy who's been lame for 38 years to rise up and walk. Then everyone goes, who can do that? And that's the point of the signs and wonders, to turn feeding 5,000 into a soup kitchen, to take miraculous healing of lame and blind and demonic, raising the dead and turn that into charitable works to prevent disease is a serious misjudgment of the nature and purpose of Christ's miracles. And it is not a legitimate way to expand the mission of the church. Okay, if you're going to say we need to do what Jesus and the apostles did, then we need to do what Jesus and the apostles did. And John Wimber and the Vineyard movement, the third wave, that's what they were saying. Hey, if this is the presence of the kingdom, then let's show the signs of the kingdom. But people want kingdom light. And I don't think it really is understanding what was going on. A second area is Missio Dei or Great Commission. And this, again, is a huge topic, but it's become the one that probably in some senses is dominating. You even picked it up in Dayton's writing. And that is that John Stott argued this way, then a fellow named Christopher Wright has come along and he's produced a couple of massive volumes in which he's arguing and really have sort of carried the day. And that's where the missional movement has really picked up a lot of its energy. The Missio Dei is the mission of God. And what they try to do is make an exegetical and theological argument that God is the sender because it's God's mission and God has been sending all the way since outside the garden. And so he sent Abraham, he sent Israel, he's sending the church, and everything about it is these are instruments to carry out God's mission. Okay, now on one sense, you know, I don't know how you can have a problem with that. I mean, God's in control, he's carrying out his purposes, he's working all things according to the counsel of his will. I don't have any problem at that point. The problem is when all that God is doing now becomes attributed to the church. When in fact, we ought to be thinking and considering whether or not God might be doing things that the church is not called to do. That we don't have the same mission as God because we're not God. We have a mission given to us by God to fulfill our portion of what God is doing. Okay, he's given government a responsibility. He's given the family a responsibility, right? Should we say the mission of the church is to raise Dave Doran's kids? Certainly the church should help, disciple, but the responsibility for bringing them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord is attributed to the parents, not to the church. So we recognize that God has a lot that he's doing. I mean, he's God. What we have to say is, where do we stand in relationship to God, and what's our assignment given to us? And God has not given to the church the full assignment of redeeming creation, for instance, which Romans 8 says he's going to do. He has not given us the responsibility to carry out all of those things. He has, in fact, given to the church a responsibility to go and make disciples. Acts 15, and we use that language, God has determined to call a people for his name, and he's doing that through the witness of the church, to bear the name of Christ to the nations and declare to them those things. It's confusing what God is doing and what the church is to do. And also, I think it's confusing what the church is to do with what individuals are to do. All right, so I have personal responsibilities to love my neighbor as I love myself. I think absolutely that's a transdispensational requirement. But really, does the church have neighbors? I mean, when we look at the love your neighbor connections, did we see Israel loving her neighbors? Was the nation of Israel under the personal obligation to love your neighbor as you love yourself? So how does the church love its neighbor? I mean, that's a personal responsibility, right? So how can we attribute it to a congregational responsibility? Or Or like, for instance, 1 Corinthians 9, Paul talks about his own personal evangelistic efforts, and he says, when I'm with this category, I'm like this, this category like this, this category like this. He's talking about himself, not the message, right? He doesn't have a different gospel for all of those people. And he's talking about himself, not the congregation, because how could a congregation do that? I mean, practically, how could a congregation shape shift that fast? The congregation can't be all things to all people. That's a personal responsibility. You can't just, okay, hey, we've got all the Jews here today, so we're going to be like Jews. We got the Gentiles tomorrow, we're going to be like the Gentiles. You can't do that at a corporate congregational level. And so what we tend to do is we take what our individual responsibilities and we immediately just transpose them to the congregation of God's people. Most of us would get really upset if the church tried to form a voting bloc technically. Probably none of us would be upset if we encouraged individual believers to vote. But a church can't vote, can it? How does a church exercise, if we believe in separation of church and state, how does a church exercise responsible citizenship? I mean, if we think there's two separate spheres, but does that mean because I'm a part of the church, I don't actually have any responsibilities in that sphere? See, we recognize that, but all of a sudden it comes to the mission and we go, well, I should be concerned about poor people. Yeah, I should be. But why does that become the mission of the church? You know why it does in our culture? Because it'd be easier for me to drop some money in the offering plate and let you feed the poor people, than me seeing the guy that needs a hamburger and going and getting him a hamburger. Because we tend toward institutionalization. We look for corporate answers to our personal responsibility. We want to pay somebody to do the thing. So anything I've got to do, I'm going to get somebody else to be my helper in it. The third kind of category I think we have to wrestle about is kingdom or church. And I know I could open up the dispensational can of worms here, all right? But I would hope most of us, in fact, even non-dispensationalists would, I think, have to recognize that the kingdom and the church are not the same thing. Nobody, I don't know anybody that actually completely carries out a kind of thought, except for maybe a Christian Reconstructionist, I should say that. But even the most aggressive, already not yet people who see the kingdom is already operative don't see the church as the kingdom. They see the church as some kind of a servant of the kingdom. So they recognize the distinction between the two. And when you confuse the two, it ends up leading to the misuse of the Old Testament to impose socio-political responsibilities on the church. I mean, just as a test case for you, you know, just about everybody who makes cases for generous justice, for mercy ministries, for redeeming the culture, seeking the good of the city, all of those things, you know what they do? They certainly get at Acts in their Bible and they turn left. Often, they stand between Matthew and Malachi and they turn left because they can't find support for it in Acts and the epistles. They just can't. I mean, you cannot find anything in the Acts and the epistles that talks about trying to bring the kingdom into the socio-political realm. You actually find statements that would go directly against the kinds of things. The kingdom is not food and drink, but righteousness, mercy, and truth. You have Christ's kingdom coming in the future. I mean, so all of this kingdom talk and this is just pet peeve, but you know, people doing church work and saying it's kingdom work is just careless. It's not actually thinking about the proper biblical categories, and the kingdom of God concept is where a lot of this came from. Go back, you want to do some history reading. 1947, the uneasy conscience of fundamentalism. One of Carl Henry's chief planks was that fundamentalism has had a view of dispensationalism which sees the kingdom as future. We need to embrace an already not yet paradigm which brings into our concerns the issues that have to do with social political realities. And if you don't think that's enough of an exposition of it, then go to Russ Moore, who used to be at Southern, is now in charge of the Ethics Commission for the Southern Baptists. And he has a book called New Evangelical. I mean, he's actually looking at that kingdom, a new evangelical theology, in which he's unpacking Henry as the basis for the justification for a socio-political emphasis in the church. So if you confuse the two, you start to bring those in. An over-realized eschatology, I think, produces that. A kind of spiritualization of the kingdom tends to reduce the miraculous signs of the kingdom to mundane good deeds. And I don't mean by mundane to minimize them as much as to say to normalize them. You know, feeding somebody who's hungry is a mundane, not a miraculous activity. Unless you can just make it happen. If you can, I'd like to talk with you, okay? It would be great. So those three categories, I think, you really cause the divide between, let's go back to Hesselgrave, the broader definition of the mission of the church and missions, or the narrow definition of proclamation of the gospel of Jesus Christ and the establishment of local assemblies. Are we incarnational or proclamational? Okay, are we fulfilling the Missio Dei or the Great Commission? Are we advancing the kingdom of God on this earth, or are we planting and establishing local churches? And those categories I think are important. I don't have time to cover these, but a shameless plug, all right? A few of us on our staff wrote a book called For the Sake of His Name, which focuses on missions. This third point, I have a chapter in there in which I try to argue that really the focal point of the Great Commission is churches planted, not just converts won. Because when we're to baptize them and teach them to observe all that Christ commanded, that's not just an individual thing. In fact, none of us as individuals can fulfill the Great Commission. The Great Commission is given to the local church because baptism is an ordinance of the church and the teaching offices and gifts are given to the church, right? So it's the content of the commission focuses on the multiplication of churches. The implementation of it immediately in the book of Acts, Acts 2, Acts 11, Acts 14, it's all church-centered. Okay, it's churches being established. They're receivers were baptized and added to them. They were assembling together. Acts 11, when it goes to Antioch, it says at the end of that whole passage, and they were there with the church for a year and taught many disciples. Acts 14, he went back and he ordained elders in all the churches. Okay, in 1 Corinthians 3, when Paul describes what happened at Corinth, he describes it in terms of planting the church. We often use it as evangelism. I planted, Apollos watered, God gave the increase. But that's not talking about evangelism there. That's talking about the church. Because he's talking agriculture, I planted, Apollos watered. Verse 9, he says, you are God's field, God's building. Verse 10, he says, and I as a wise master builder laid a foundation and others are building on it. So planting was laying the foundation, watering was building on it. So he described his ministry at Corinth as a church planting ministry. And in Romans 15, when he talks about his work being done in Macedonia and Achaia, he says, there's no more place for me in this region. And most interpreters take that as not that everyone had heard the gospel or that everyone, we know not everyone had believed, right? Because Thessalonica is in that area. And in 2 Thessalonians says, not all have faith. So we know there were people who were still lost, but Paul says there's no more place. Well, if the mission is just reaching people for Christ, then you can't really say you have no more place until everyone's won. But if the mission is establishing local assemblies where the name of Christ is being named, and that's the phrase he uses there. And he says, so I want to go to a place where Christ has not been named so that I won't build on another man's foundation. There's no more place to lay foundations for me here. Okay? That he viewed the mission of the Church of Jesus Christ, and I put it in a sentence there, that is mine, not his, all right? New converts, which form a new community, which aims to plant new congregations. Okay, so they're new converts through the gospel, which form a new community around the gospel, which aims to plant new congregations for the spread of the gospel. So Thessalonica is a great example, right? Gospel came to Thessalonica, and it says, and for from you it echoed out into all Macedonia and Achaia. That's what should be happening in our churches. We have been planted, and it should be echoing out from us into the regions around us, which would mean make disciples, baptizing them, teaching them to observe. And that would necessarily, I think, mean we're establishing churches, and that should be happening to the ends of the earth among all the unreached peoples and places. And the priority has to be on calling them to believe in Jesus Christ as their Savior. And it'll have profound impact on how we live. But the mission of the church isn't to go clean up the culture. It's to rescue people who are perishing and then see it go from there. Yes? Amen. And my concern is just that we need to have our eyes open, because even good people, okay, and I don't want to get into names and everything, but you know, people who've written missions books that we would look at and go, that's great stuff, motivating us to missions. You look at what their church is doing in missions, and they have missionaries dedicated to creation care. So they're in East Africa to help people take care of the land and to work on global renewal in that way. And I think that's just the evidence of the camel's nose that has come into the tent. And if you look at the early 20th century, it ought to be at least an enormous warning to us, because of what happened. And the fact that the third wave of it, the missional movement, is so openly opposed to good ecclesiology. That is, it actually is almost obliterating the gathered church, is the danger. And especially when that starts to get pushed in our circles, that the real mission of Jesus Christ is to take, you know, bits of heaven and bring it to places of hell on earth is I think it will be a disastrous thing, because my personal view on it is because we're all inherently materialists, and what I mean by that is not we want money, we see and think in material terms. I can see a person who's hungry and I feel it right away. I could drive past a guy in his Jaguar and I don't immediately think he's going to hell. See, I can identify with pain and hunger, suffering. That's why sometimes we can get people more lathered up in about preventing abortion, which we ought to be as individuals very concerned about. You can get them to line up in an anti-abortion rally, get them to come out and do an evangelistic campaign. Why is that? I mean, why is it that we care more about people's bodies than we do their souls? I mean, I'd turn their argument completely around. Why would I put a priority on people's temporal well-being ahead of their eternal well-being? That doesn't make sense. I'm not saying we ignore the other, but it's not the church's mission to do that.
Thanks for bringing out some clarity to some of these terms like incarnational
right.
And things like that. I think from a distance, it sounds good.
Right.
Until you bring exegesis to the scriptures, you want to really think biblically. So thank you for doing that. My question for
but you, no, I'm just kidding. Yeah.
Because I think we need to think through things. And you read and you just go, oh, that's great stuff.
Right.
You want to make a difference.
pursued to get into different countries, to go to the ends of all nations.
Right.
How would you respond to that? What are some safeguards we can put up?
Well, what I'd say, and this is a simplistic one, but if you take that last line at the bottom of page 2, it would be, they should be on a trajectory toward new converts, which form a new community, which will plant new congregations. And if they can't, in my mind, if they can't show a direct connection between what they're there to do and that, then I think it's a problem. Now, it doesn't mean it's a problem that they're there. Okay, I mean, if somebody, we have a lady from our church who was teaching English in our Christian school who was just burdened about how many lost people there are in a country like that, and she said, I want to go teach English there. And I said, that's a great thing. But, you know, it's not, unless she's partnering alongside of somebody who's pursuing the new community, new congregations, it's not missions to just go and be a Christian in an unchristian place. It has to be wired to the Great Commission. Now I will not criticize people who live in hard places as a believer. What I would say is they need to be doing what Jesus told us to do and what we see done in the book of Acts and confirmed in the epistles and not leave it undone. And my understanding of it is a woman can't be a church planter. So that's going to be a limitation in some degree. But just building a business, I don't think is missions. But if you have to be bivocational in the States to plant a church, we don't have a problem with that, right? If they have to be bivocational in Turkey, I don't have a problem with that. If they have to be bivocational in Beijing, I don't have a problem with that. So I don't think it's wrong to say, I mean, we wouldn't want to eliminate bivocational ministry. So someone can be a bivocational church planter in a lot of these places. They need to have a sense of identity that makes sense to them and to the people among whom they live. All right, so if I'm in Beijing as an English teacher, I actually should be an English teacher. Okay, so that makes sense. If I say I'm an English teacher and I never teach anybody English, all I'm doing is evangelizing, then it's going to come across like walking in craftiness like last night. I'm deceiving people, and that's going to undercut the credibility of the message. So we need to have integrity in what we're doing, but there's probably people at this conference who are pastoring churches while they're working another job, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I don't think there's, and Paul did that at times, so... So we don't want to rule that out, and sometimes we have to do that to get into certain other places. So, yes, sir.
I'm just wondering your perspective of James, where he says, you know, the brother or sister is making a destitute baby. Why don't you say, depart in peace? Is that even a church?
I would say it's a personal, individual responsibility, because it's all in the test of faith, right? So it wouldn't be showing to the church, show me your faith. He's talking to an individual, just like in near context, he said, you know, if you don't listen to the word, you look into the mirror and you see it and don't change. And then he talks about visiting the fatherless and the widows. I think those are personal responsibilities that are evidence of genuine life. Oh, I'm sure they would, yes. But what they would be doing is transposing personal godliness to corporate responsibility. And I think that's the problem. So if I was doing it, I mean, I'd say like the apostles said to Paul, right? Remember the poor. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with saying, you know, a genuine Christian will be concerned about these issues. Our tendency in our culture, though, is to say, well, if I should be concerned about them, then the church should have a program for them. And I think that's where we get all this cluster up of things that eventually, at least seems to be the repeated historical pattern, and I know a historical argument is not as strong as a biblical argument, okay, but if I see a repeated historical pattern of the distraction and dilution of the church's commitment to the scriptures and fulfillment of the mission, then I should certainly be careful about it, because Proverbs does say, The prudent foresees the evil and passes by. The naive goes on and is punished. So I think there was one back there real quick. Was there one? I think they left.
Creative access.
Okay, good. Yes, sir.
Would 1 Timothy 5 be a good example of like where the church takes care of the widows, but then Paul says in the end, you know, let not the church be burdened.
Right.
If other people are going to do this, let them go ahead and let them do it.
Right.
Yeah,
the two things I'd say, I think your point is exactly right, which is that it's first a personal responsibility, but if there's not someone who can personally do that, then the church would. But then the other thing to really zero in on is that Paul is not taking, there he's not saying every widow. It's widows who are on the roll. So he's actually talking about a way in which we care for those who are of the household of faith, not that we should start a widow ministry for the culture around us. So I think there's clearly a prioritization. Even the poverty issue, Acts 11 and 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, the church at Antioch, Acts 11, the churches of Macedonia and Achaia are sending it to the believers in Jerusalem. So their benevolence was targeted to help those who are of the household of faith, not that they were going to, I don't think there would be any biblical justification for neglecting other opportunities, but the stuff you see about like major collections sent far away was for the believers. It wasn't just, boy, there was a famine in some country, let's take up an offering and send them money. It was let's help God's people who are experiencing this, because we're to do good to all men, especially those who are the household of faith. Okay, and I need to do good to all of you by letting you go eat lunch. Okay, so thank you very much for being patient with the start and finish.